This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
It's interesting. Sometimes you have to do something for a while, a long while, before you can actually really understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
And for me, with making films in Philadelphia, making films about Philadelphia, I think in 2014 I may be able to better name, or maybe not, what I have been doing over the years than in 1986 when the bombing of Osage Avenue was made. And I think a lot of it is connected with culture broadly, not just filmmaking, but really, and with culture I include the humanities, I include history really, as being not only entertainment, or not only this kind of leisure activity, and not only, you know, culture for the kids, but culture as being this really vital tool that we have as a way of being strong. And particularly for communities that are disempowered or struggling, the ability to gain the tools of culture, history being a really important mm-hmm. one, it's... you know, I don't want to be grandiose, but it's a site of struggle and of a really essential struggle. So I think a lot of the work in many ways it does, the bombing of Osage Avenue has a lot to do with the sort of the beginning of that work, is really how do you how do you regain the authorship of the history that you're involved in, particularly, and in Philadelphia, I think we're clearer that history is not, it also has this economic power. I mean, you know, that's why we have this whole historic district. I mean, it's a right. huge, it's a lot. So, the ability for communities and neighborhoods to define history, redefine history is really essential. So I guess that's probably the beginning. Yeah.
I mean, I said this to Louis before we started, that one of the things I really love about this film, in contrast, for example, to another film about the bombing of Osage Avenue, Let the Fire Burn, from last year, is that it really does situate what happened within a long history as opposed to being an exceptional event that is a kind of sensationalized moment, but thinks about a long history, and partly it's a long history of aerial power that is very much relevant to our own moment. So it would be interesting after the film maybe to talk about right. that mode of power. And
since you brought it up, and also this whole area, this whole idea of, you know, archive is really the creation of archives and the acknowledgement of archives really is part of the history process. I was actually just reminded reading a wonderful chapter in Nora Alter's book where she's quoting Michel Brauffriot. In some ways, it's not just about making films. It's really helping communities to really think about the archives that we have. And once you have the archive, then you're able to put forward a narrative. So the thing about the commercial archives is, it's easy to be kind of it's easy to accept the archives as being some sort of objective truth and not realize that there is a position of the camera. Who's paid the camera person? What stance does that camera person take? So if you are using a commercial archive, and this sort of goes back to Let the Fire Burn, and just presenting it as a kind of objective truth, as opposed to interrogating that and providing some kind of other way of understanding that particular documentation, then you may end up replicating the same stance as the original
right.
capturer.
Right.
Anyway, we should watch and
watch
talk.
The film. Yeah, okay. So, Louis, thank you for that film.
Sure.
I think what I'd like to do to just start us off is to start with where we ended and the question of community power, because it seems to me that that's something that both of your works, you know, engages in some way. And one of the things that really strikes me about this film is the way that it looks at all kinds of different community leaders in different types of organizations, from within the family structure or within different religious communities or citizen groups. And it's, you know, interesting to me that you foreground those. But then also the political, you know, leaders are part of this massive explosion of violence, and in a way the abdication of responsibility at an early moment when a group of political leaders are called upon to respond to a community. And so I'm wondering if both of you could say something about how you see the political organizations that are involved in these narratives and in your work, what role you see them having in terms of fostering this idea of community power. Like, what are the different versions of community power that your work engages?
Well, there are a couple pieces, particularly in the show, where I really think of the idea of community relationships to organizations and sort of politics as being really symbolic to, I think, what makes a community in a way. And so in the show, for example, I used a Pan-African flag and the colors and sort of this abstracted symbol of Rainbow Push as a way to sort of place the images and also in a way to place the politics of the space. And also thinking about how these sort of politics and these sort of groups, these organizations sort of can activate different sites in similar ways. Mm-hmm. So Rainbow Push, for example, being something that was established primarily in Chicago and or by political activists in Chicago, in a way activate a space here in Philadelphia, maybe differently, but has sort of a relationship and a power here that can be transformative. And similar to Pan-African flag itself, and that being sort of something that's not just about one particular site, but something that mm-hmm. resonates throughout different spaces.
Uh-huh. It's interesting when I think of community organizations and people organizing in communities. We are so used to identifying and acknowledging those organizations that are somehow officially recognized. And if it's a nonprofit, it's a 501c3. If it's a corporate entity, it's got some other tax designation. So in some ways, organizations that are recognized by the powers that be are organizations that have somehow molded themselves to fit into these kind of system, you know, whatever slots. Right. When in reality, there are many different types of organizations. And institutions form in lots of different ways, and some institutions will form in ways that can be embraced and can be accepted by the powers that be. But it seems kind of logical that a revolutionary organization or an organization that is at in its essence questioning the way this society is organized is not going to be necessarily one that one can easily identify. And those organizations still, and I'd say even now more today than in 1980 and uh-huh. certainly more than in 1960, those organizations are the ones that in some ways have a lot of possibility, but in some ways are the ones that are most endangered and the most dangerous right. to the structure.
But to anyway. The structure as it is, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. And it seems to me, I mean, what the film really brings out in an interesting way is that, you know, there is this tension between the residence and yeah. move, and but also a set of human relationships and an empathy yeah. and an understanding of where they're coming from, and I think a desire for a dialogue, right, right. and a compassion for the kids who are hungry, or, you know, all these different moments. And it's as if within the kind of officially articulated society, there's no place for that dialogue.
Right.
And the film, in a way, insists on holding a space of memory for the desire for that dialogue and what happens when that dialogue is not allowed to happen. And I think that's one of the things that's really fabulous about right. the film. And, you know, it seems to me that that's, in a way, that one of the afterlives of this event is the kind of work that Scribe is doing in terms of making sure that those types of conversations are happening and are in a public space, they're at International House, and that they're in mm. communities.
I'm also thinking I'm also thinking about the push piece, and because push to me is a really interesting the push Jesse Jackson's push organization in Chicago. It's a really interesting. I was going to say model, but it's a really interesting kind of formulation to study, because what happens when an organization that is sort of based on fundamental change does everything in its power to try to fit within the system, that is, you know, tries to get corporate funding, tries to, and not to say all those things are bad right. for the, but
right.
can yeah, I mean, I really wonder, trying to change things, within the system is extraordinarily difficult, but the other side is that you really want to have good people and you really want the system to work. You don't want to desert the system. So there really is that huge tension.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think that the model that MOVED had mm. of where you're working from the outside to really affect change, to me, I think it's an interesting one and definitely different than what something like a Rainbow Push would do, where, like you were saying, it's almost more like a corporate structure and you're working with the city, definitely. Yeah, I think it really does depend on the circumstances of right. the type of change and how quickly the change will like really exist and see itself.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it raises the question of the role of economics yeah. in both your work and the narrative that you're telling in this film, and how economic and the question of class and how. Economic development and economic opportunities are, you know, part of how a community emerges and how differences articulate themselves, but also how people get access to political voice, right? And that question of how one accesses economic development and what the kind of positive or negative possibilities of that are is, I think, something that would be interesting to maybe talk about.
I mean, particularly in the film, I mean, the difference that they talk about when the group moved from 33rd to 62nd, and just that difference in how that community was treated in terms of the quickness and the pace and the response of the police to work with the community.
And one really, really key thing to remember is, you know, what happens when you become an enemy of the state. So after Powelton Village, the MOVE organization was clearly an enemy of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And those stresses, I mean, you see it with, I mean, I've been working on this project, Muslim Voices of Philadelphia, and so I'm aware of like a lot of different Muslim groups around the country. And so once an organization gets targeted by, let's say, the FBI, there's stresses that happen within the people in the organization, and sometimes behaviors become not necessarily rational. They become really defensive, warlike behaviors. You see it with some organizations in New York that, for whatever reason, the New York Police Department at one point sort of decided to focus on them. And then you see this, what seems like, why is that organization doing that? And you realize that they're under this enormous pressure. You'd mentioned Tony Kidd Bambara earlier, who had a lot to do with the making of this film. I had been working at the public TV station at Channel 12, and actually had produced the MOVE Commission hearings, which were this like, I forget, 16 days of like live coverage, and it really was a tremendously politicizing experience. Certainly, to listen to testimony for 8 hours a day for 16 days. But it also, my analysis had been quite. I was a TV producer, so in my analysis, I was working from that public TV station, and I think the analyses that were coming from media, sort of mass media, were not sufficient to explain what was going on. Either it was an indictment of Wilson Good, the first black mayor, saying, and the idea being like, see, you elect the black right. mayor, and next thing you know, a bomb gets dropped. Or the other analyses was the MOVE people were a bunch of crazy people, and whatever came upon them, they deserved it. And neither of those analyses seem accurate or useful.
Right.
Or,
right.
And I think, Tony's, really working with me, coming really from the outside. I mean, I asked her to work with me on the project. Really brought this whole, definitely another analysis, but also this whole experience as an organizer. Mm-hmm. And so there were lots of discussions about MOVE and MOVE 1985. And that one of the things that organizers in the 60s knew is that the first thing you do is you have the community embrace you. The community is if you're a political organization working for change, then that relationship as a cultural worker, as a political person, is to have a tight relationship with the community. But once you are facing these pressures of the state, people start doing crazy things. Mm-hmm. Anyway, long answer to explain maybe why that some of the things happened, some of that rupture between community
right.
and movement.
Yeah, right. Now, Toni K. Bambara, it's interesting you mentioned her when her voice is in there. I mean, one of the things I see her doing, and I want to link that to what you see yourself mm-hmm. doing as an artist, creating interventions into spaces, is that the rhythm of her poetry, in a way, is drawing attention to the way that language functions as a force. So when she emphasizes wildlife, it raises all kinds of questions about what type of life is recognized as life that belongs in civil space, or how do people, objects, animals, things get articulated within language, and what impact does that have on who's allowed to live in different ways. And in your own work, it seems to me that the way that you use the human body mm-hmm. in your interventions is a really important aspect of the kind of awareness that you're raising about spaces and habitation, and the way that things can make us aware of things that we might not otherwise see. And
right.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about really how you think about what you're doing with bodies and in relation to things and spaces.
Yeah, I think for my work too, specifically towards the end of my time here in Philadelphia, it was really important that the work leave the interior of my studio and go out and sort of bring the reference of people, of goods, of these things that I was actually encountering in West Philadelphia back, like, outside into the work. So, watching the video, it was interesting to the relationship of how people constantly, or residents constantly spoke about, well, you do these things inside your house, you mm-hmm. don't do them outside. Mm-hmm. And really thinking about the body and these materials entering out into a space that was open, that was sometimes not being used, sometimes were being used,
uh-huh.
And really thinking about activating these spaces in different ways to suggest other ways of living, other ways of being. that could become part of sort of the conversation and the narrative of these places that are overlooked. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think that's why it was important, because it could start to become a conversation just outside of just what happens like inside or internally or in the exterior, but something that everyone could have a conversation in and see possibilities for other ways in which you can interact with these things, people, and spaces that oftentimes we, as you were talking about, it's either this or that, this sort of relationship. There's like really no space in between. So I think when you're able to put your work out there into the public, not just the final thing, but actually the making of it, it allows for different conversations to happen that oftentimes don't happen because we want to talk about like the finished thing.
Right. So. Right. And I think this ability of artists to, in a way, perform the capacity of the human imagination is really linked to an idea that came up throughout the film, really the question of political courage and what does political courage look like and what do we need to, how can we empower different communities to have that courage? And I think the demonstration of imagination to, and the ability to imagination life otherwise, and to imagine one's possibilities otherwise. So if one goes to, say, the city and says, I need help with this, and they say, well, this is what we're going to do, how does one find the imagination and the courage to articulate something other than that and to believe that one has the right to that type of imagination? And I think belief is also a really strong theme in the film, like, what kinds of beliefs sustain people and which ones are more useful than others.
Hi, my name is Maurice Henderson. I work with Tony K. Bambara and Louise James. I'm not quite sure Louise James' take on this production is the same as you all's number one. I think she has a different take on this whole portrayal of the organization. And number two, I found it interesting, Tony's work on belongingness and disappearance with this MOVE thing and the thing about the Atlanta child murderers. I found that to be, that's something that she was really getting herself into before she passed away. So can you comment, number one, on what's Louise James' take that you know of on this? And then number two, Tony K. Bambara's objectivity towards belongingness and disappearance.
Okay. Louise James has just finished a book on John Africa, it's out, and Louise actually was at Scribe last week for our open house and was talking about it. We haven't really. I know Louise is a friend. We haven't really talked about the film per se, but we definitely have talked about the bombing, and we've talked about the aftermath of the bombing. But we really haven't talked about the film. I think it's because in some ways. In my way of thinking, the film is, if you have gone through this, the film is irrelevant. I think if you haven't gone through it, there's great relevancy, or I hope there is. But I do have great respect for Louise James, and it really was Louise's testimony during the hearings that was one of the most enlightening experiences. Because Louise James I had only known Louise James by sound bites and prior to the hearings. That is 30-second sound bites. And she, in those 30-second sound bites, the character that was being presented was this insane, harridan, just out of her mind. Allowing her, listening to her and letting her provide her full analysis, I realized this is an extraordinarily intelligent, clear person, and her anger, you can understand every bit of it. if given the space. In terms of Tony Kidd Bambara and disappearance, I think one of the things that was very important to Tony and something that she talked about and wrote about was not defining community by deficits. Because in many ways, once you do the deficit defining, or it becomes, that's when the pathology, framing happens. And so it's really important to look at how this community functions. And once you kind of can understand how a community functions, then not only do you see the deficit, but you see some way to get around the deficit. So I'm not sure if I'm really answering your question, but yeah, that's my take on it. Yeah.
I think for me, which is interesting, as an artist and someone who, my grandparents actually live on 6241 Pine. And so it's just interesting, you know, I've seen this film many times, but never in a space such as this, where we're talking about it, where one of my good friends is making work in reaction to things like this. So it's very interesting having this all come together. Some of my earliest images that my father gave to me as treasures were images taken from the aftermath of this space, of this event, this horrific event. And that this has been a constant thing throughout my family history, you know, and like my grandparents made a dark room for my father and they instructed him to use his camera, use that to document his life, to have a voice. So I grew up with him telling me how after this event, he was arguing with police to get those images, to get those first, the footage, you know, and so that's always resonated with me. And so I think that just, you know, my grandparents still live there. They refuse to leave.
What are your grandparents' last name?
Suber.
Suber?
Yes. Amos. Amos Suber is my pop-up.
Okay. Probably somewhere in there.
Right in the middle. And I just remember that, you know, how it stayed with them. You know, my grandmother still has a fear of being in the front room because of what happened. And just them working so hard to get this space. And so I think what the film does for me and what some, you know, artists are doing, like Jessica, going into these spaces is the attention to detail and the small things that I think are really important to keep that conversation. And going back to the space, the houses are still, they're abandoned. You know, Osage Avenue is a vacant space, you know, and I think it's not just because people don't like the houses or the cost. I think there's something that is in that, you know, and so I think, Jessica, you know, investigating and going back to these spaces and putting work to that is important because there's still something in that space, and there's a reason why those space, that, you know, block is still abandoned, you know, because of that energy there and what happened. And so it's just very interesting going to visit my grandparents and how the community as a whole has changed. And there's a little bit discomfort for me, even though I grew up in that area. I went to their house. It's still, so for me, this is really, really, really personal. And it's just really interesting to be in a space, not just with my family or watching it on my own, where we're talking about this. So it's really intense. Mm-hmm.
One of the things in the context of this exhibition that is interesting to me is that the exhibition moves us or asks us to move and to think and to walk around between images of that block in West Philadelphia and move into an international arena and think about questions of belonging and home and security and the, you know, whether one has the right to be still or not from a local to an international context. And I think about where we are right now, and I think we're sitting between Osage Avenue on the one hand and then Penn on the other hand. I'm a faculty member there. It's one of the places where we're producing drones through our military-funded research. And so then you know, to me, one question that comes out of the long history that you lay out at the beginning of the use of aerial power within the context of the formation of the United States and the articulation of the nation is how then do we think of ourselves as residents of both West Philadelphia and of a United States that is using drones to, you know, remotely demolish people's homes and livelihoods and possibilities of living and to, you know, displace them. And, how does one begin to think from that local to the national to the international? What are the kinds of, how do we think about the place of your, I think both of your work has a place in that and can be very productive for that conversation, but it's a complicated kind of set of layered identities that we have to take on in a way to do that.
Yeah, no, it's... for me, and Jessica, I don't know how you think about your work in terms of audience, but I've lately been really obsessed with something else connected with Tony K. Bambara, this whole idea of authenticating audience, which is suggesting that demanding that the work have utility, that when you're creating work, you're really thinking like, how does this push us forward? How does this change things? How does this improve things? You know, for this particular film, and I have some regrets about some things, but it really had the immediate utility. It was made a year after the bombing, and it was made for Philadelphians. It wasn't made for broadcast or screenings and whatever at Ouagadougou, or other places. It was really made for a local screening here for a very particular audience in terms of providing some kind of context and analysis. And I think, you know, when the work, for me, when that work has clear utility, but I feel like it succeeds in some way. Mm. Not to say that other more formal or aesthetic issues aren't important, but that's
right.
I didn't answer your question, but no.
I do think of audience within, you know, my practice and making work. But I think, you know, my abilities as an artist, and when I think of like sort of my strong suits and wanting to really get the work out there, I definitely start with a place in terms of like historical moments, ideas about community and things like that are of much interest to me. But then for me, I'm also drawn with, you know, the symbolic and also the materiality of things. And so I like that, or I would like and I hope that my work can function on many different levels where the audience can recognize the symbolic or the materiality of something and enter it that way. Mm-hmm. And or also recognize the context in which I've started from, whether it be I'm pulling text from, you know, a specific historical moment or a certain symbol. But I kind of like to have that sort of fluidity within the work because I think it allows for the process to come in and to, again, I guess the earlier point of offering up alternatives to kind of see these moments that have happened, kind of create some sort of rupture where people can enter and think about these possibilities differently.
Uh-huh. I think we have another question here.
Louis, because I was going to ask the question, you sort of raised it in your conversation. What are your regrets in doing the film? And
what
are your regrets in doing the film? And also, having the hindsight, what would you do differently?
As I said, I mean, the film was made for Philadelphia that at that point was really still wrestling with this and trying to come to some understanding of it. I think even more context. I wouldn't try to define move. I wouldn't. I don't think that that wasn't what this was trying to do. But there are some other contextual things that I would have done. Well, you know, if I could have shot in HD, and you know, that would have been nice. There are definitely some technical. I mean, you know, this is 30 years ago. I was a younger person. Yeah, I think providing a there's some other contextual things I would have done, and
like what? Can I?
Some aspects of the burning, I would have made much more explicit. The fact, some aspects of the burning I think would be made much more explicit. And I was trying to listen to the neighbors, and I think some of this, you know, there's some things that either I needed to do more of or less of, in some of that. But you know, as I was in the back of the room, I'm thinking like, oh, it's over. I can't redo it. It's done. You know what I mean? Like, you know. And maybe, you know, being aware, having a much more, you know, the internet didn't exist in 1985 or whatever, 86, or at least I didn't know about it. And just being, you know, being aware that works have other kinds of, you know, making a work for another kind of context. But in some ways, I think a cultural worker benefits from identifying an authenticating audience. And if you feel that you've reached that audience, then you maybe let it go. And an authenticating audience is maybe in a particular time. They may be temporal and spatial. You know. Yeah.
In your film, did you have a chance to, did you think about, I know you said that, you know, it's done, it's been finished, but would you have gotten, you know, the mayor or had some of the police speak?
I did try to talk with Ramona was, I think, I remember going to the first day of her trial, and by the time I was shooting, she was already in prison. So I couldn't get to her. And Louise, I tried a couple times, but she didn't want to talk at that point. I didn't want to get the police or the mayor. I really they're in archival. That wasn't the piece I wanted to make.
Okay, well, I want to thank both Jessica and Louis, and I encourage you to go look at Jessica's work at the back if you haven't already seen it, and really appreciate your time and your work.